Welcome, readers and romance seekers, to Hopelessly Romantic Behind the Page. How has everyone been doing this week? I myself, personally, have been loving this nice, warm weather with sunny days. We are finally seeing the end of cold winter, and now I just can't wait to be sick of summer in a couple of months. But enough about spring and hope and joy and all that lovely nonsense. How did we like A Bride for the Lost King? Well, if you listened to my last episode, you'll know I hated it. Its predecessor, His Majesty's Forbidden Temptation, just managed to avoid the shelf of shame. It got a 3, I think. But sadly, this novel absolutely failed to clear the bar. There was just so much wrong with it. Where do I begin? The secret kingdom? Pop-Tarts? Potential sexual grooming? Yeah, it's a lot. And I could go on and on and on about my little nitpicks. And, you know, because this is my podcast and therefore allowed to do whatever I want, I'm going to do exactly that. So I'm going to lump both books in for this little bit here. This just really struck me as strange and unusual. What is it with Maisie Yates and pets? We remember from the first book that Tinley had more than a few animals. She had a cat. And King Alex, or whatever the hell his name was, hated all of them. He hated the hedgehogs, he hated the ferrets, and he hated that little cat. And for some reason, we're supposed to like this guy as our hero. And I thought that was just a one-off quirk. It's something to make, like, our couple bicker while we watch them go from haters to lovers for that stupid trope. And then here along comes Agnes in A Bride for the Lost King, and she's weirded out by the fact that Tinley had these pets. Pets that were kept in the palace. Shock! It's like she's never heard of such a thing. I don't think Agnes can really claim ignorance here. It's not like she grew up sequestered from the world in the way that Lazarus supposedly had been. I have a hard time believing that she just didn't in her entire life encounter people with pets. The only thing that I can think of that would explain this is maybe Yates has this preconceived notion that Europeans just don't have pets, or at least keep pets inside the house. I'm really trying to figure this out because it doesn't make sense otherwise. Like, pets are a thing that people have and enjoy. Now, the other thing that really got my steam up was the entire concept of this micronation. The other thing is, I hate that there's no name for this place. Like, it's called the People of the Trees or the People of the Woods. There's no actual name, which makes it very difficult to talk about. It's like it could have been, like, you know, Tree Village or Tree Place. Anything other than just, like, you know, that secret country where all the people are. But the setup is not possible in this, the year 2022. Okay, the book was published in 2021, but my point still stands. You cannot have any sizable population of people without somewhere, somebody knowing about it. There are still tiny little societies that have absolutely zero contact with the modern world. And we still know about them. We know where they are. That's why we know to stay away from them. Google Earth alone would blow this whole thing out of the water. You can't tell me that some nerd, like myself, bored at 3 a.m. scrolling around for funsies, wouldn't have noticed a small village with a freaking castle carved into the mountainside. It's not possible. I can't accept this. And related, something that really, really got me laughing was, because I just had to know, I went on to Goodreads to check the reviews of the book. I've mentioned this before. I don't like doing this because I want to keep my opinion as uninfluenced as possible. I don't want to be... I just don't want to have any preconceived notions, you know, of what I'm going to think about this book. I want to be as clean as possible when I go in. So I was delighted to find, as I typed up this book to look at the reviews, that a sticking point for a lot of the readers was the fact that this little tiny micronation had internet access. Because they're right. You can't do that. You cannot be secret and have internet. It's not possible. I'm sorry. It's hilarious to me that, you know, Google alone's like, hey, where are you right now? Okay, here you go. Here's your little satellite imaging. Amazon's on its way. Like, no, because wouldn't you? Okay. In this, the year of 2022, you could have anything that you want at your fingertips delivered, thankfully, by that blue smile box or whatever the hell. And it's going to be there in like 24 hours. You're not telling me that there's going to be some 15-year-old with zero impulse control and just a tablet who's going to be like, oh, I want this, and clickety-click, and it's there, and suddenly the whole thing is ruined, unless you've got the most powerful firewall this side of North Korea. So, yeah. And reading all of the reviews that mentioned this little tidbit, well, it was like breathing life back into my soul. Dramatic, I know, but I was genuinely dumbfounded after reading this novel. This might sound elitist of me, you know, given the fact that I've got that super fancy English degree, but I was really disheartened by the fact that this book made it to publication. That's why I made that declaration that I did at the end of the review, because I fully believe that Yates puts a manuscript into Harlequin's P.O. box, and an automated computer program sends a direct deposit check without anyone really caring about the actual quality of the novel. There's a story that my dad likes to tell about quality versus quantity. In it, there is a class of pottery students. One half of the class is tasked with making one pot, one single pot, as perfect as they could make it. The other half was tasked with churning out pots as fast as possible, no matter the quality. At the end of this experiment, the single pot half of the class does not have a very good pot, but the mass pot production side has excellent pots that exceeded the quality of the single pot group. In their process of churning out pot after pot, they learned with each one, and therefore became better with every mound of clay they worked with. This is not a good metaphor when it comes to writing books, I'm afraid. Sorry, Dad. I'm not saying that agonizing over one manuscript until you deem it perfect will result in a masterpiece. Of course not. Perfect is the enemy of good, again, as my father likes to say. Perfection is an impossibility, and as such, a best writer can do is, well, their best for the manuscript and then move on. But if you churn out pot after pot, you get immediate feedback. Like when you're working with the clay, you really quickly learn what works and what doesn't in that process in order to make a good pot. You don't really get that feedback when you've finished a manuscript. You've just banged out words on your keyboard and ta-da, it's done. You don't have to look at it again. It's not how that works. It requires a team. It requires test readers, editors. It requires the author to go back and just look at things. And I don't think Yates had any of that at her disposal when she brought in this book. She probably has to churn out another book or 10 more by the end of the year. And she just really can't focus on, you know, making this manuscript any good. And she doesn't have the team, apparently, I don't think, with, you know, editors or test readers. She just doesn't have that team behind her, and she's not getting the feedback that she might need with what would make the book good. Of course, I'm wildly speculating here. I don't know anything about her process. I don't know how she's writing these books. I don't know what happens to the books after they get sent to Harlequin for publishing. But I don't think a lot happened. I do not think a lot happened after the spell checker ran through, and then it goes right to publishing. If the book had any editing, it came in the form of a spell checker, and I don't think it had anything else. Harlequin made sure that the book didn't have glaring grammar problems and then sent it off to their print shop. It's just, I don't think it had any more involvement than that. Genre also kind of causes a problem, I think. The point of the Harlequin Presents series is to embellish a lavish, jet-setting life. That's the point. More often than not, these are Cinderella story romances, where person A, usually the heroine, comes from a background of nothing and is swept away by the glitz and glamour of a life of luxury or royal splendor. And that's what's happened with Lazarus and Agnes, except Agnes wants nothing to do with it. She hated being used like a mannequin doll for a charade she wasn't agreeing with. As she talked with Tinley and Alexius more, that she's like, these are good people. I don't want to do this anymore. So forgive me if I don't appreciate the money that Lazarus was spending on Agnes. And I hated the way that Agnes was talked about, the way other people talked about her, specifically Lazarus and that lady in the shop. They called her a creature, and I hated it. I hated it so much. She's a person. She's a person who was shoved into a life of indentured servitude against her will. The book wants us to know that it was her choice. She asked for Lazarus to take her back with him to wherever he was going to go after he saved her life. But we need to think outside that perspective here. She was 16. She was about to be murdered in a back alley street in a foreign country. Her father, the only other person who could conceivably take care of her, was dead. She is unlikely an undocumented foreigner with zero papers or identification. Where the hell else was she gonna go? And Lazarus spent way too much time patting himself on the back for treating her so nicely. Oh, yes, you let her sleep in a real bed. How magnanimous of you. And then we hit the point where he considered the possibility that he saved her and took care of her to not maybe get a bodyguard out of the deal, but a, quote, bedmate. I was ready to lose it right there. Grooming. That's what that is. And I don't care what anyone else says. That man groomed that poor girl. And now she's stuck with this dripping trash bag of emotional abuse wrapped in human skin because he finally decided to admit he wanted to have sex with her. Oh, that was another thing that I don't think I brought up in the review, mostly because it infuriated me to the point of incomprehensible rage, just like it is now. The book made a big damn deal about Agnes's virginity. She said something to the effect of her chastity being proof of her commitment to being a warrior, some bullshit. It's totally fine, of course, that Lazarus was getting his dick wet whenever he wanted. It's proof of his masculinity, his strength, and his virility. Gag me with a spoon. See, this is why I don't read things like this very often. I just go off on wild tangents about petty crap, and I forget to be insightful or critical of points that actually matters. The way I should with the review. Okay. Anyway, back to the genre thing. If this story wasn't constricted by the Presents label, I think it could have been worked into something not bad. I won't say that it needed a fantasy label, and it doesn't exactly fit into historical, maybe something like historical fiction or fantasy adjacent. Because if it's removed from its 21st century setting, I think a lot of problems with the manuscript could be solved. Amazingly, I would up the score that I gave it for realism, because if it was realistic in the setting presented to us, it would change how I scored it. I didn't give A Wolf in Duke's Clothing a 3 out of for realism because I felt like it. It got a 3 because the story worked in the setting, but it didn't score higher because, you know, werewolves. But I am at risk of actually going a little crazy here. I'm looking at my levels and, oh boy, I bet my audio is going to be really fun because I keep trying not to yell. So I'm going to go ahead and end the segment, and it's more than likely that I will avoid Yates in the future unless I somehow develop amnesia. So sorry, but that is how the cookie is going to crumble. Anyway, what did I read this week? Well, other than the book for our next episode, it was a little bit chewy to get through. I have been thoroughly enchanted by the Lady Emily series by Tasha Alexander, so much so that I have burned through the first 2 novels, and I am already into the middle of the third. So, Do you like murder mysteries? Do you like Victorian historical drama? Do you like sociopolitical dances? Well, you will eat this up with a spoon. This is probably going to be another one of those examples of, well, I am not a fan of X, but I really like this X type thing. Because again, I'm not really that big into mystery. And other than Bridgerton, I didn't really have a thing for historical drama. But, you know, I think I find things changing in that. The first novel in the Lady Emily mystery series, And Only to Deceive, tells the story of Lady Emily Ashton, newly widowed after having just been newly married. Aww. Her husband Philip had gone on a hunting safari in Africa. Yes, I realize this is problematic. There's a lot in the book where I'm just, oh yes, the British Empire. It was a colonialistic trash fire. Got it. But yeah, just keep all that in mind. But while he is in Africa, he had gotten sick and died. Now, Emily didn't get to spend a lot of time with him. They were barely married before he had gone off to Africa, and so she really didn't feel a lot of affection for him. Again, this is where a world where the marriage mart is a thing. You make a advantageous marriage, not a love match. So, because she didn't really know him all that well, she learns more about her late husband through his old journals, letters, and she discovers his love of Greece and its antiquities. She just kind of learns the subtle enjoyment of looking at a red painted pot, I think. Red painting vases for Greek mythology. I don't know exactly what it is. But she's, all the while, she's challenging social norms of the day. And while she's doing all of this, she uncovers a mystery that will change everything she thought she knew about her husband, for better or for worse. The next two are just as delightful, in my opinion. They are A Poisoned Season and A Fatal Waltz. They become much more political as it goes on, and more than just then Emily's reputation is on the line in each book, because, you know, a woman's reputation is everything, and the hot goss will destroy you if you're not careful. I won't spoil much from there, but I'm really recommending y'all give this series a read. I do want to say that if you're going in with the audiobooks, I don't know about any of the subsequent books, but the first three, each one is a different narrator, and that bothered me a lot. I would probably be less bothered if the third narrator, I don't remember her name, was as good as the first two. The one for A Poisoned Season, I think, is my favorite out of the three, followed by the one who read for And Only to Deceive. The Poisoned Waltz, I could do without her, honestly. So keep that in mind if you're going in for the audiobook versions. This might be one where you might actually want to read the page, but I can respect that it might be difficult. I don't know about the rest of the series, because I don't think my library app has them on tap, unfortunately. And regretfully, I have not done research beyond that. I haven't gone and looked to see if the audiobooks actually exist. But anyway, I won't say much more about it, because I really do recommend you read them. They are really fantastic. So this is where I will leave you for now. I will see you all next week as we read Pretty Little Lion by Sulika Snyder. Thank you for joining me, readers and romance seekers, and I hope to see you once again for Hopelessly Romantic Behind the Page. If you like the show, please visit us at hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. If you have questions or want to recommend a read, please email us at contact@hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. Also, if you can, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It will go a long way to help the show, and that way I can keep bringing you fun episodes. The show was written and produced by me, Heather Songster. Our technical advisor is Kwang Hin Cho. Hopelessly Romantic is an H with K production. And it doesn't matter what you read, only that it's what you love.